Okay, so we're going to be looking at this case. State of Missouri v. Community Alternatives Missouri, Inc. And, this is a deep dive that's going to kind of get into a question that I think is really, really important for future legal professionals. And that is how a corporation can be held criminally liable for neglect, even when, the people who are like directly, responsible for the bad actions aren't like the top executives.
Yeah. I mean, think about it, right? The legal system's looking beyond the boardroom and saying, well, how do we hold this entire entity, this company, accountable?
Right, exactly. And it's not, the CEO or, the board of directors. It could be, and we'll get into it, but it's about, is there somebody who has enough authority to be considered, almost like an extension of the corporation itself. And so we're going to be focusing on this case that involves a really, sad situation in a group home setting. And we'll be unpacking the legal concepts of, what is a high managerial agent? And then also, like, what does imminent danger actually mean in a care context?
Yeah, those are two really big
Yeah.
questions.
Huge, right? Like they're kind of fundamental to this whole analysis.
Yeah, the sources you've given me are great because they go into a lot of detail about, all the facts of the case and the legal arguments that were made, on both sides, and how the court kind of reasoned through all of it.
Exactly. And our mission here, just to be clear for you listening, is to like pull out the pieces that are going to be the most relevant, the most interesting, the most thought-provoking, especially thinking about you as, future legal professionals. You want to learn things quickly. You want to learn them well. And you want to know, like, how does this actually apply in the real world?
Yeah, and I think if we can zoom out for a second, just to give everyone the bigger picture, this case, I think, really highlights how the legal system is looking at corporate care more and more.
Especially for like vulnerable
Yeah,
populations.
exactly. It's not just enough to have, a good policy on paper. It's like, well, how is that policy actually being carried out, at every level of the organization?
Huge, right? And are people being, adequately trained? Are they being supervised? Are they, are they being held accountable for actually following the policies?
Exactly. And are they being set up for success,
Yeah.
right? I mean, are
Yeah.
they being given the resources and support to actually implement these things?
That's a great point. Yeah. And all of that comes back to the corporation, right? Like the corporation is ultimately responsible for creating that
Yeah, and
environment.
that culture,
Yeah. Okay, so let's actually get into the specifics of this case. So, the case is about Community Alternatives, Missouri, Inc. This is a company that ran over 30 group homes for people with developmental disabilities.
Wow, 30, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a huge operation,
Yeah.
right? And so the one that we're focusing on in this case is called Turtle Creek Group Home, and it was in Bolivar, Missouri.
And I think it's important, as we're going through this, to keep in mind that this was a larger corporation, right,
Right,
with
yeah.
multiple facilities.
Yeah, not just like one little, mom and pop shop type of
Yeah,
thing.
exactly, because it raises all these questions about, well, what kind of oversight was there across the entire organization? Not just at this one particular home.
For sure. And the systems, right? Like what systems did they have in place to make sure that things were running properly and people were being cared for properly, across all of these different
The
facilities?
communication, the training, all of that.
Right. And so a really important person in this story is Mary Calura. So she was the lead staff person at Turtle Creek. And her role was really, really important. Like she was the one who was managing the residents' medical care, and she was also supervising the other staff members.
So she was wearing multiple hats, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. Like she was both a caregiver and a manager.
And that's interesting because the sources really highlight that dual role, right?
Yeah.
That she was both, hands-on with the residents and also responsible for what other staff were doing.
Yeah, and that becomes really important for the legal analysis, right? Like when we talk about corporate liability
Yeah.
and, who's responsible for what, right?
Okay, so now the individual at the heart of this case, his name was Gary Oheim, and he was a resident at Turtle Creek, and he was non-ambulatory, so he couldn't walk, and he had communication limitations, and he was also prone to developing bed sores. And, I think just taking a moment to think about his vulnerability, right? It really highlights how serious this situation was and how important it was that the people caring for him were doing their job properly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his condition, being non-ambulatory and having difficulty communicating it really puts a lot of responsibility on the caregivers, right? To identify and address any potential issues.
Right, and especially with bed sores, because those can develop pretty quickly if someone's not being moved properly or if their skin isn't being cared for properly, and so it's just a really vulnerable situation.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that you know, the combination of those things, you know, his physical limitations and his inability to communicate his needs, you know, it really magnifies the potential harm of neglect. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like if he can't say, hey, I'm in pain, or, you know, hey, I need to be turned, or whatever, like it's completely up to the caregivers to be proactive and to make sure that he's being taken care of.
Exactly.
Okay, so the timeline of the alleged neglect is really important. So from October 2001 to January 2002, so we're talking about like a three-month period.
3 months, okay.
Yeah, Mr. Oheim's condition got a lot worse because he wasn't getting the right care for these developing bed sores. And so it's not like this was just a one-time thing, right? This was a pattern of alleged neglect.
Yeah, and that's crucial when we start talking about imminent danger, right? It's not just a single mistake or, you know, a momentary lapse in judgment. It's this ongoing failure over time that creates this predictable risk of harm.
Right. And so there's this one incident that's really important. And it happened when Mary Kalura took Mr. Oheim to a medical clinic, and she actually prevented the doctor from properly examining him for these bed sores.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she said it wasn't necessary, and she only like tilted him to the side while he was fully clothed.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so, you know, for me, as I was reading this, that was like a really telling moment, because it's not just, you know, a passive failure to provide care. It's like she actively obstructed medical attention.
Yeah, you're right. That's a huge distinction.
Right. And so, you know, for our listeners who are, you know, future legal professionals, think about how that kind of action is, you know, it just adds so much weight to the argument that there was a knowing disregard for Mr. Oheim's well-being.
Yeah, and for his health and safety.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's one thing to maybe not recognize the severity of a situation, but it's another to actively prevent a doctor from, you know, doing a thorough examination.
Right. And so tragically, Mr. Oheim later died, and it was from complications that were related to these bed sores. And so this obviously made the whole situation, you know, even more serious. And it probably played a big role in the decision to actually file criminal charges against the corporation.
Yeah. I mean, while the death is obviously a terrible outcome, you know, the legal focus here is really on the neglect that happened before that.
Okay.
Right. They had to prove that the lack of care directly led to this imminent danger to his health, and that this neglect could be traced back to the corporation through Kalura's actions.
Yeah, and so this whole thing led to something that's actually kind of rare, which is that the Corporation Community Alternatives was actually convicted of resident neglect, criminally convicted. And mm-hmm. So it's not very often that you see, you know, a company being charged with a crime in this kind of context.
Yeah, you're right. It's usually more like civil lawsuits or, you know, regulatory actions.
Right. Like, you know, fines or, you know, having to change their policies or something.
Exactly. But a criminal conviction, that's a whole other level.
Yeah. It means the state was basically saying, you know, what you did was so bad that you deserve to be punished, not just
culpability.
Exactly.
The severity of the offense.
Right. So the company appealed their conviction, right? Yeah. They said we shouldn't have been found guilty. And their argument was that there wasn't enough evidence to support the two main parts of the charge.
Yeah. So let's break those down.
Yeah. So to really understand how the court made its decision, we have to look at this Missouri law about corporate liability, and it's section 562.056.13. And this is different from the more common idea that an employer is automatically responsible for whatever their employee does. Like if I'm working at a store and I, you know, accidentally spill something on a customer and they slip and fall, my employer could be held responsible for that, even though they didn't directly do anything wrong.
Yeah, that's the idea of respondent superior, right?
Exactly. And so that's often used in civil cases. But in criminal cases like this one, the standard is higher and it's more specific. So in Missouri, you have to prove that a high managerial agent either did the bad thing themselves or they knew about it and they let it happen.
Okay, so a higher level of involvement. It sounds
yeah, like. And a more direct connection between what the corporation is doing and the actual crime that's being committed.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, so under this law, the prosecutors had to prove two things. First, that a high managerial agent of the corporation was involved in the neglect, and second, that this conduct created an imminent danger. And so we're going to break down each of those pieces because they're both really important.
Okay, let's do it.
All right, so first, that phrase, high managerial agent, what does that even mean?
Right, because it's not just, you know, anyone who works there.
Right, and so the law actually defines it in a different section, 562.056.32, and it says that it includes not only, like, the officers of the corporation, you know, the CEO, the CFO, all those folks, but it also includes any other agent who has basically the same level of authority when it comes to supervising and managing other employees.
So it's not just about your title. You know,
exactly.
It's about the power you actually have.
Right. It's like, what do you actually do day to day? You know, what decisions can you make? Who can you tell what to do?
It's about function, not just form.
Yes, exactly. And that's really key here.
Yeah, because they're trying to figure out, you know, could this person's actions be attributed to the corporation itself?
Right. Like, were they acting on behalf of the corporation in a way that makes the corporation itself responsible?
Exactly.
Okay. So what evidence did they use to show that Mary Kalura fit this definition?
Well, she was the lead staff person, right? She was responsible for managing all the residents' medical care, and she was supervising the other staff at Turtle Creek.
Okay, so already we're seeing some real responsibility there.
Exactly. And she also had the authority to train other staff to evaluate them, to even discipline them if they needed to be disciplined.
So she had some real power over her subordinates.
Right. And then on top of that, she was the one who had the company credit card for buying supplies. She went to management meetings, and she even did training for staff at other group homes.
So she was involved in more than just, you know, her little corner of the world.
Exactly. And to top it all off, her corporate supervisor, the person who was like directly above her in the company, only visited Turtle Creek about once a month. Oh, wow. So basically she was running the show there.
Yeah. Like day to day, she was the one in charge.
So all of that together, you know, it really paints this picture of someone who, even though maybe she didn't have, you know, VP of something on her business card.
Right.
She had a lot of actual authority.
He was the boss.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the court is looking at.
Right.
Right. They're saying, well, does this person's role, does it look like someone who could be held, you know, responsible for the corporation's actions?
Exactly. And you know, the fact that her supervisor was only visiting once a month, it just reinforces that idea that she was operating with a lot of independence.
Yeah. And autonomy.
Yeah. And so now let's look at the second part that the state had to prove, which is imminent danger conduct. And the law says that this is more than just regular negligence, right? It has to be a real and serious threat to someone's health or safety or well-being because they're not getting the necessary services, and it has to be happening over a period of time.
So it can't just be a one-off mistake.
Right. It has to be like a pattern of neglect that's creating this ongoing risk.
Right. And that risk has to be pretty serious, too, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, it has to be something that could really hurt someone.
Right. It can't just be like, oh, they might get a little bit sick. It has to be like, this could lead to serious injury or even death.
Exactly. And so what evidence did they use to prove this in this case? Well, her blocking the doctor from examining Mr. Oheim is huge.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Right. And they also presented evidence that she was intimidating the staff and telling them not to talk to the doctors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then the fact that Mr. Oheim's bed sores got so bad, they progressed to stage four form over just 3 months.
That's really serious.
It is. And that really shows that there was this ongoing and escalating danger to his health.
Yeah, because that kind of damage doesn't happen overnight.
Right. It takes time for it to get that bad. And so it's not like, oh, they just forgot to turn him one day. It's like there's this pattern of neglect.
Right. And that progression to stage four, that's a really powerful piece of evidence because it really suggests that there was a serious and prolonged lack of basic care.
And then, of course, there's the fact that he died, and they were able to show that his death was directly related to this neglect.
Right. So all of those pieces together, you know, they really paint a clear picture of imminent danger.
Yeah. And the law, you know, it really emphasizes that it's about the failure to provide those necessary services. And that timeline is really important, too. It shows that it wasn't just a one-time thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So the Missouri Court of Appeals, they ended up upholding the conviction. They said, yeah, the corporation is guilty.
Okay.
But there's this interesting thing that happened. One of the judges who agreed with the decision to uphold the conviction, he wrote a separate opinion called a concurring opinion. And in that opinion, he said, you know, I have some doubts about whether there was enough evidence to show that Kalura had enough authority to be considered a high managerial agent.
So even though he agreed with the outcome, he still had some reservations.
Yeah. And so that tells us that this whole question of, you know, how much authority did she have and was it enough to make the corporation responsible? That was a really tricky question.
Yeah, even for the judges who were deciding the case.
Right.
It wasn't a slam dunk.
And so a key thing here is how appeals work, right? So when a case goes up on appeal, the defense, in this case, the company, they were arguing that there just wasn't enough evidence to prove their guilt.
Okay.
But here's the thing. During the original trial, they didn't give the court certain documents that could have helped to explain exactly how much authority Kalura had within the company.
Oh, like what kind of documents?
Like organizational charts or policy manuals, you know, things that would show, you know, what her job title was officially, what her responsibilities were supposed to be, you know, who she reported to, all that kind of stuff.
So basically the stuff that spells out the corporate hierarchy.
Right. And so the problem for them is that because they didn't give those documents to the court during the trial, they can't really use them on appeal.
Oh, this is like too late now.
Yeah, the appeals court can only look at the evidence that was presented during the trial. They can't just add new stuff in later.
Okay, so that's a big lesson for any future lawyers out there, right? You got to make sure you have all your ducks in a row, you know, during the trial itself.
Get everything in there, yeah.
Because if it's not in the trial record, it's going to be really hard to use it on appeal.
Right. And so because these documents weren't part of the trial, the appeals court had to rely on what the jury decided based on the evidence they did have, and they had to do this under a legal rule called the Jackson v. Virginia standard.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that one.
So basically, this standard means that it's really, really hard to overturn a jury's verdict just because you think there wasn't enough evidence the appeals court has to basically assume that the prosecution is telling the truth, and they can only overturn the verdict if they think there's absolutely no way a reasonable person could have found the defendant guilty based on what was presented during the trial.
So basically, they're giving the jury a lot of deference.
A lot, right? And so in this case, the prosecution did a good enough job of showing that Kalura was a high managerial agent and that what she did created an imminent danger. And because the defense didn't have those other documents to argue against, that the jury's decision stood.
Right. So they really shot themselves in the foot by not including those documents in the first place.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and the judge who wrote that concurring opinion, he specifically said that it was really hard to figure out exactly how much authority Kalura had without those documents.
Yeah. So that's a big takeaway, right?
Yes.
Make sure you've got all the paperwork you need
For sure.
if you're going to trial.
And it's interesting because the fact that her supervisor only visited once a month, it actually ended up hurting the company's argument
Really? Yeah,
because it made it seem like she had even more authority. You know, if nobody's checking on her very often, then she's basically free to do whatever she wants.
Oh, I see. So it backfired.
Yeah,
It
exactly.
actually reinforced the idea that she was in charge.
Right. And so this case, you know, it's got a lot of important lessons for future legal professionals. So let's talk about some of the takeaways, starting with corporate compliance. So for companies, especially those that work in healthcare or caregiving, what does this case tell us about what they need to be thinking about?
Well, I think the big one is that you need to have really strong oversight systems in place. And that's especially true for people who are in middle management. You know, those folks who are kind of in between the executives and the frontline staff.
Right. They're the ones who are actually making sure that the policies are being followed day to day.
Exactly. And so you need to make sure that those people are being properly trained, that they're being supervised, and that they're being held accountable for making sure that people are getting the care they need.
And it's not just about like checking boxes, right? It's about actually creating a culture where everyone understands that providing good care is the top priority.
Yeah, it has to be ingrained in the fabric of the organization.
Right. Yeah.
It can't just be lip service.
Okay, so for those who are thinking about going into criminal defense, what's the big lesson here about how to defend a company or a person in this kind of situation?
Well, this case shows just how important it is to have all the relevant documents ready to go.
Keep everything.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
you need to have everything that explains how the company is structured, who does what, who reports to who, all of that stuff. Because if you don't have those documents, it's going to be really hard to challenge the prosecution's case.
Especially on appeal.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what about for folks who are interested in becoming prosecutors? What can they learn from this?
I think this case highlights how important it is to build a strong case that shows not only that neglect happened, but that the person who was responsible for it had the authority to make decisions, and that their actions or inactions created a real and imminent danger.
Yeah, it's about connecting the dots, right?
Exactly. You need to show a pattern of neglect, document any attempts to cover it up or to prevent people from getting help, and
Yeah.
really make it clear that this person was in a position of power and that they used that power in a way that put people at risk.
And this case really proves that just because someone doesn't have a fancy title doesn't mean they can't be held responsible for a crime. If they have the authority to make decisions and to control what's happening on the ground, then they can be considered a managerial agent for the purposes of corporate criminal liability.
Yeah, it's a reminder that the law is really focused on substance over form.
Exactly.
It's about what you actually do, not just what your title is.
Right. And so this case, State of Missouri v. Community Alternatives Missouri, Inc., it's a really powerful reminder that neglecting vulnerable people has serious consequences, and that the law is increasingly holding corporations accountable for what happens under their watch.
Yeah, and I think it's a sign of things to come. You know, I think we're going to see more and more cases like this, where the focus is on holding not just individuals, but entire companies responsible for ensuring the well-being of the people they're supposed to be caring for.
Yeah, and the fact that one of the judges had those reservations about the evidence, it's a good reminder that these cases aren't always easy, you know? There are a lot of gray areas, and sometimes it's really hard to figure out where to draw the line.
But the key takeaway is that documentation is crucial, right?
So important.
Having all the right paperwork can really make or break a case.
Absolutely. And so for you listening as, you know, future legal eagles, you know, think about this case and how it might apply to your own work. You know, whether you're advising companies on how to stay compliant, defending them in court, or prosecuting cases on behalf of the state.
Yeah, think about your role in ensuring that corporations are acting responsibly and that the people they're serving are being protected.
It's a big responsibility, and it's something that we all need to be thinking about.
Absolutely. And this case is just one example of the kinds of challenges and questions that you might face in your legal careers.
So much to think about.
Yeah, but that's what makes it interesting.
Bro,
right?
Wait.
It's not always black and white.
Yeah.
It's about really analyzing the situation, applying the law, and figuring out how to achieve justice.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, I think this has been a really insightful deep dive, and I hope our listeners got a lot out of it.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
It was great talking to you.
Likewise.
All right, everyone. Until next time.
See you later.